Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Good evening, everybody. This is session 4 of Buddhism in a Nutshell. Do we have anybody that's new tonight? A couple of people? It's okay. Welcome. Have you ever been to a Buddhist center before? Okay, can I ask, are you here for a class? Just out of curiosity? That's a good reason. Just fine. A lot of times we get students to come, and then I find out that they've got a term paper tomorrow, and so please can we answer these questions tonight? So I just like to make sure that I don't have anything like that. We're okay? Okay. And for you, ma'am? Okay. Just check. I know, isn't that amazing? When all of a sudden you open your eyes and there it is. Yeah, that happens to a lot. So just as a very brief explanation, this is a 5-session class. You're here on session 4. The first probably 2 sessions really cover most of the history, which you can read, you know, in just about any book. The third class, last week, we started getting into a little bit, and we'll do a brief review of last week's class before we head forward. So this is beginning Buddhism in a Nutshell, so it's very low level, so you're going to be just fine. Don't worry that you missed anything drastic. I do like audience participation because it just helps the night go a little faster. So questions are always welcome and good. Okay, so again, this is session 4. My name is Sandy Carlson. Before we get started, as always, we're going to take a few minutes to just settle our mind. One of the things that we've been doing in this class is doing brief introductory meditations, because that's really the basis for a lot of working with your mind in Buddhism. So, and a lot of this is for my benefit, because I always come in a little frazzled from being busy all day. And one of the benefits to helping to lead this class is that it helps center me. We're going to do the meditation that we ended class with last time. Again, my plan for this is to always introduce a new meditation at the end of the class and then start with that meditation at the beginning of the next class, because that way you get to try a couple of them. And then it's your responsibility and or choice and or opportunity to take these meditations and try them at home and on your own. And if you've got any questions, this is the class to be asking. We do have the following class that I'll talk about when I find out when it's scheduled, is a meditation 101 course. And in that class, you'll have an hour and a half to work with a teacher just on meditation and meditation practice. So this is really just an introductory, just to kind of dip your toe in the water and give it a try. So come on in. Sit wherever you are comfortable. And we're taking just a brief moment to settle our minds and do a mini meditation. No, you're good. Like I said, it's always that last minute trying to get here. Okay, so if you remember, we have our 7-point meditation posture, and it's sitting with your legs. If you're down on the floor, it's sitting whether you're full lotus, half lotus, or just legs crossed. It's just about getting a stable position. If you're sitting in a chair, you keep your legs in a position where your feet are on the ground. If your legs are too short, you put them up on the cushions. And that, again, we're looking for a stable base. There's a reason for everything that we do. Arms, hold your hands loosely in your lap. In this tradition, we put our right hand on our left, thumb slightly touching, and just slightly underneath our navel. Your arms are a little bit out from your body, and the reason for that, again, is to allow air to circulate. Your back is very important. It should be straight, not stiff, but straight. Shoulders back a little bit, kind of that regal position, I call it, because it opens up the lungs and allows you to breathe a little bit easier. Arms slightly focused down on the ground. You can have them closed if it's easier for you, but what you want to avoid is having your eyes closed and your head down to where you're sleepy, or your head up and your eyes wide open to where you're distracted. So it's kind of that middle way. Head tilted slightly forward. Your mouth and your jaw is not clenched, but your teeth are closed, and your tongue is on the roof of your mouth right behind your teeth. And the reason for that is to help control the saliva buildup. Again, the reason that we're doing all this is to get into a comfortable position that can be held for a long period of time so that we can work with our minds without the distraction of our bodies. So there's nothing holy or religious about this position or about sitting on the cushion. We're trying to get a stable base to allow us to work with our mind. That's the 7-point meditation posture. And actually, in some of the Buddhist texts, you're going to hear about sometimes they add an 8th. And the 8th can be working with the breath. And that's one of the things that we've been working on, is the different practices, concentration meditations that we've used to work with our breath. We try to find a neutral thing that we can work on, and your breath is always with you. So it's a good one for that. Okay, again, let's just go into that quiet place. Get our 7-point meditation posture together and just start breathing naturally. So while you're doing this, use one of those breathing meditations that we've already done, whether it's counting the breaths or just that bare attention where you're breathing in and out and you're focusing on the breath at the opening of your nostrils. So I'm going to give you just a few minutes to just focus on your breath. Right now we're coming to that place, settling down, beginning to focus. So we're letting go of all of the distractions of the day. And we're going to create an altruistic motivation for this session. I think that we're meditating not just for our own individual benefit, but we're taking the time now to meditate, develop our minds to become wiser and kinder people. And it's really that simple. Because if we are wiser, if we are kinder, if we are more compassionate, it ripples out. And it does have the possibility of being of benefit to all sentient beings. That's that Mahayana motivation. So start by practicing bare attention. That's that breathing in and out. Your focus is on your nostrils, the air going in and out. When you gain a deeper level of concentration and focus, loosen your concentration slightly and emphasize the element of mindfulness in your meditation a little bit more strongly. Allow your mind to be attentive and observant of whatever comes to notice, regardless of what it is. Don't identify with the mental elements arising. Simply observe them like a tourist. Allow them to rise as you observe them and pass away without getting involved. Don't follow the thought. Just be aware of it. Allow your mindful attention to expand, to encompass your entire sphere of experience of consciousness. Try to forget that there's an observer and something being observed. Simply imagine your experience, your consciousness, as being just like the sky, completely clear, vast, spacious, and without end. Concentrate on this experience and identify with this experience. Clarity, spaciousness, awareness. Our minds are completely clear just as the sky is completely clear. And the light of the sun shines down on us through that clear sky. Our awareness and wisdom shines through the clarity of our minds. Sometimes clouds fill the sky and obscure the sunshine, but the sky doesn't get upset. The sky doesn't identify with the clouds. The sky doesn't judge. The clouds just pass through that spaciousness of the sky. They come and they go. The clarity and spaciousness of the sky isn't compromised by the clouds. They just arise and pass. Our minds are clear and aware and spacious like the sky. When a thought or an emotion, an idea or an image a sensation arises in your mind, just observe it. Let it rise and let it pass. Each thought, each mental event, just like a cloud. Your mind, the sky. For example, right now there's a train passing, and many of you probably heard the whistle and your mind went right there with that train. We can hear it. So that's the practice. Don't identify with it, let it go. It's just something that happened and it passed through your mind. Concentrate on the experience of space and bliss that is your mind. Whenever we identify with and are carried away uncontrollably by a thought or a feeling, we lose any awareness of that spacious clarity of our mind. We lose awareness of the vast, clear, and knowing nature of the mind within which each thought or feeling occurs. Our perspective becomes small and constricted. It's as if all there are clouds and we've lost the sky. We lose that wonderful open spaciousness. When we can simply observe these thoughts and feelings arising without getting involved, when we can identify with the sky instead of with the clouds, then we can reside in that spacious purity of our basic clarity of mind. Calm, clear, peaceful, open spaciousness. Without agitation, without delusions, without anxiety and distress, without dissatisfaction and attachments and aversions. So I'm going to let you just reside in that spaciousness of the clear blue sky for 2 minutes. So I'll time it. You don't have to worry about it. Bring your attention back to the room. And now we're going to dedicate all that positive energy that we created through this practice of mindful meditation to becoming a better and better person who's more at peace in life and who can bring more peace and well-being to others in every moment of every day. So we bookend. We set an intention and then we dedicate. So it's kind of that we're setting the purpose for why we're doing it. And then we're giving ourselves a pat on the back because we actually did it, okay? Because we don't give ourselves enough credit, so it's kind of putting a bookend. And if you can actually think about doing that for different activities through your day, you can do an intention when you wake up in the morning, and you can do a dedication at the end of the day. Do that for your day. Try this tomorrow, okay? So when you wake up, set an intention for the things that you're going to try to do that day. We'll talk about this more maybe at the end of class. And so if you set your intention, you'll be much more purposeful at the beginning of that. And then dedicate at the end of the night. Boy, I did so many great things today, did a few things wrong, But I'm going to be aware of those and try to fix them. But I did some things right today. A lot of times in business meetings, I'll set an intention before the meeting, and then I'll dedicate afterwards. So you can bookend everything in your day that way. It helps to create that little bit of mindfulness that we're all kind of looking for. Now, before we move on, and even start with the review or anything, if you remember, last class I gave you some homework about how many people are still doing the red light practice. Anybody still kind of working with that a little bit? Did anybody come up with your own little trigger? Remember we talked about maybe trying to find something that triggers for you guys? Anybody think about that and try to come up with anything? You don't have to. Chris, do we have the mic? Has anybody tried to come up? Because, again, this is about your mind, so things that work for you.
I guess it was about triggers that make you aware.
Yep.
Well, the only thing I noticed during the week, because my bike broke, but before that, on the ride, a couple of rides I had this week, when I have to shift, not just shifting on the same ring, but when I go from the big ring to the small ring,
yep.
You know, especially like when I'm going up a hill, it's a dramatic shift. And it just, the sound and the difference of the tension, because it's really different, makes me aware, okay, hill, you know, and just it just makes me very aware of that sound and that difference in the way I pedal.
Okay.
That's.
Do you try to maybe think, so I love that you're aware of what's going on. Now if you can take that trigger,
yeah.
Okay, and then make it an intentional, and again, I'm just throwing ideas out. Okay, so now all of a sudden you're going uphill, you're going to make that trigger to where you've got to pedal harder. So maybe it's that thing that while you're going uphill, I'm going to work toward enlightenment, or I'm going to work to be a better person. I'm going to take something, take that very activity that makes you mindful, and think about a way to turn that into something that's going to make you think about doing it. I'm going to take that same analogy because somebody else that I know uses going upstairs. So when they go upstairs, as well as being very mindful about health, so they use the stairs instead of the elevator, like me, obviously. And so they think about taking everybody with them upstairs so that they're bringing all sentient beings out from enlightenment. So they think about these things. So take that and maybe try to think, okay, I'm working uphill for the benefit of all beings, so I'm gonna bring them all out of the dark or whatever. Again, this is about triggers for your mind to help you become more aware and mindful about things. But it's just some of those fun things. Again, this is about how do we take these tools that we're learning and bring it into everyday life. What I'd like to do tonight is try to get through some of this information maybe a little bit earlier and try to end class a little bit earlier because I'd like to try to do an analytical meditation at the end of this class so that we have the opportunity to talk about it a little bit and then talk about it again because next week is going to be our last class. So as we've been talking about working with our minds and the two types of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism, concentration meditation, which is that practice in getting our minds stronger so that we can concentrate on the subject, and then taking a subject, an analytical meditation, to work with our minds and actually change our minds. So I'd like to try to end maybe about 10 after so that we have some time to do a full-on analytical meditation so you can understand what I've been talking about and then have a little bit of time to talk and then maybe a little bit of time at the next session to talk about it and try it again. Okay, make sense? All right. One of the other funny things is I know that these are being recorded. I normally don't listen to myself, but as I was planning tonight's class, how many times do I say the word all right or okay? I'm really sorry. I think that's one of my speech triggers to make sure that I'm stopping and pausing. But, oh, man, I don't even like to listen to that. So our plan for this evening is going to be a brief review about what we did last week, and then we're going to talk about precious human rebirth, the Buddhist view of death, the three scopes, and the three principal aspects of the path. Again, we're still working in this whole context of the Four Noble Truths so we can bring this around. So before we go any further, let's just do a real quick review because it all starts coming around. Again, I'm gonna wing through this because this is review for most of you. If you've got questions, stop me. And I wanted to say one thing. The gentleman that software, how you were looking at the mind suffer, I started thinking about that. That was a really good analogy about the mind and how things work with the mind and how that the mind and the brain are two separate things. Yeah, the hardware and the software. I really thought that one through a little bit more, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought that actually was a really good analogy to separate, because the mind is not the brain. Okay, and the analogy that this gentleman gave was that it's like a computer, the hardware being the brain, and then the software that we put on it is more the mind. So it was just an interesting analogy that I had not heard before, and I think it worked. So Buddhism is about the mind. Everything in here is about our mind. And I'm trying to give you those examples of how to try to work with your mind every day. Because Buddhism truly is more a way of life. And so we try to work in these practices as a way to work with our mind. Because we believe that developing the positive states of mind leads to happiness, and removing the negative states of mind that cause suffering, that's the definition of enlightenment. And Buddhism believes that every single person in this room, every single person on this planet, every single sentient being on this planet has the ability to do this. So that's one of those things that I personally find very inspiring. So defining the mind again, consciousness, we can use these terms interchangeably. Non-physical, it's not the brain. Clear sky, does that meditation that we've been doing, does that kind of give you that open feeling? If you can kind of identify with that clear blue spot, especially here in North Carolina, when there's not a cloud in the sky and you can't see the trees or anything, all you can see is that clear blue sky. And if you can let your mind think like that and understand that the thoughts that are running through your mind constantly are like the clouds. So you have the choice of what thoughts you put in your mind and how to make them positive and negative. Okay, you have the power. You have the ability. The mind is aware. Sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, and mental awareness. In Tibetan Buddhism, they add that mental awareness to those five senses that we talk about in the Western world. And its function, its job, is to know. That's what it does. No beginning and continually changing. So we talked about those moments of mental awareness, mind moments. And we do have the ability to work with our minds. We have the ability to change our minds. And that's actually what it means to be Buddhist, because we're looking within for that change. The outside, the external, is not the cause of our happiness or our suffering. It's internal. And so we're looking within. So getting into karma a little bit, everything has a cause. You'll hear this over and over again in different terminology, different language, but it's cause and effect. Everything has a cause, and because the mind is non-physical, it can only be produced by something non-physical. Each moment of mind is produced by a previous moment of mind. So where did this one come from? Remember we talked about, you can remember last night's dinner probably, yesterday, what you did at work or what you did at home, and kind of you can start to follow your mind back a little bit. Okay? So that helps to explain a little bit of that continuity of consciousness that we talk about, that mind stream, and the fact that that doesn't end. And when you work with it from a Buddhist perspective, you can follow these moments of mind all the way back through your life, all the way back through your childhood, all the way back through your birth, all the way back to the previous life, and so forth and so on. So it's like this river, okay, that is constantly moving, constantly changing. And because it's changing, you have the ability to work with it. It's not the static thing. Okay, we're talking about samsara, is another term you hear about quite a bit in Buddhism. Cyclic existence. It is that beginningless, recurring cycle of death and rebirth under the control of karma. And delusion, those obscurations that we talked about. So karma is action. It's the working of cause and effect. Remember we talked about it being like gravity. Gravity is a law. It is a natural law. And who was it? Isaac Newton, right? Apple guy? Gravity, he discovered it. Same thing with the Buddha. The Buddha didn't create karma. He discovered it. He discovered this natural law. And since he's not a god, and he couldn't just use magical powers to give us all enlightenment, he was a man. He did the next best thing. He started to teach. And so all of these things are the teachings of this man who became enlightened because he discovered the workings of cause and effect, and he discovered that all of the happiness and suffering was in his mind. And so when he was able to become enlightened, that's what he started doing, is teaching. Positive actions produce happiness. Negative actions produce suffering. That's really kind of a duh, right? You guys are so quiet. This is a very quiet class. It is. I've noticed that. So I mean, but you keep coming back, so we must be doing something right. So, okay, karma is a psychological process. It is not out there. This is in your mind. It is a psychological process. There isn't a cosmic scoreboard out there. Okay? It doesn't work that way. This is your own process in your own mind. Four laws of karma. I'm going really fast. Are you guys okay with this? All right. Anybody not okay? I should be asking that way. Anybody have any questions? At any time, stop me. Okay, karma. Here are the four laws of karma. Karma is definite. This is a law. It's just like gravity. If you're on this earth and you crawl up a ladder and you step off, you're going to fall. Law. Karma is definite. Virtuous actions always bring happiness. Non-virtuous actions bring suffering. Karma expands over time. This is that ripple effect. So let's say you say something. Karma is good and bad. Everybody always thinks that karma is negative. Karma can be positive. So it's used in the West. So I mean, I've got a cousin named Karma, for heaven's sakes. I've got hippie, you know, cousins, and they name their daughter Karma. The way that we use karma here in the West, it's always negative, isn't it? Ooh, karma's, you know, karma's a bee, you know, I said it. We use it as a negative, but karma is neutral. Karma can be good, karma can be bad. We don't think about the fact that we're all having the karmic benefits of sitting in this center. We all have the karmic benefits of this beautiful sunny day today. Okay? We all had the karma to be, you know, enjoying this last week. Now it's going to get hot next week. But karma is positive, we too, right? That's always that funny thing that people, I don't know why everybody goes negative, but we do. So karma expands over time. So that kind word that you said, you know how you don't know how far something can go. That's, what is it, the random act of kindness that everybody does? Okay, so to us it might be a little random act of kindness, but boy, that made a lot of difference. And so you don't know how deep that can go. I've had personal experience with that where I thought something I did was very small, but it was very big. So karma expands over time, not only for what you might do here, but karmically that can grow. So your good actions will really expand over time. Your negative actions also expand. Yes, sir. Mike, please. We got a couple of them coming.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
So you said that karma is a psychological process in your mind, and there isn't a cosmic scoreboard or judge out there.
Correct.
So wouldn't that imply that the definition of what's virtuous and not virtuous is a subjective definition for every person, or are you saying there's an objective definition of what is virtuous and non-virtuous?
Well, we definitely have a list, okay? And so it's a very defined list. And I'm going to, let me see if I'm answering this well for you. So we have that list of the non-virtuous that we went through last week, and we'll do it again. So this is a list that is in our minds that we go by, that I think we've went through some of it, that it's a pretty commonsensical list, right? Not killing, not being mean, lying, things like that that are pretty much basic. I think one of the things that might help you is that this is not, for instance, in the Christian world, where it is, where you have God that is saying what's right and what's wrong, God's will right? So that's coming from outside. So your job as a Christian would be to follow God's will, correct? Whereas in the Buddhist world, we're saying this is this internal thing that pretty much applies to everybody. That is, I think, a list that we can all. So does that make sense a little bit or not?
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, some people might think a certain action is virtuous, and other people might
say, Okay, we'll talk about that. That's a good one.
So how, what are the karmic effects if karma is within your own mind?
Okay. So let's give me a specific example, because I can come up with some, but I want to make sure.
Oh, I mean...
Something that you think is virtuous that she's going to think is not, correct?
Yeah, I
so it's subjective. So you're saying that there's a list that...
I mean, I'll just try to think of a rant.
Yep.
Maybe there's a person that thinks keeping their child locked in the room is virtuous because I'm keeping them safe, but really you're
okay.
You're smothering them, so that somebody might think, well, that's not virtuous. You're hurting them.
Right. Like okay. That. So some of that stuff... So there's got to come that point of wisdom. Okay? So now you've got the karma of... Well, you have the right intention, okay, even though it's, you know, maybe screwed up, but your intention is good, correct? So we're not, I don't have it here, but there's other parts, and again, this is because we have, you know, a full hour to talk about this stuff, whereas in Discovering Buddhism, they've got 6 weeks to just study karma. There's more to karma, and there's more to karmic effects, and more to karmic levels. So to go down that path, there's the intention that you have is part of the rating. What is your intention? Even though you're doing something that's wrong, your intention is good. So not so bad, right? So you have the heaviness of the karma. So there's about 4 or 5 things that will lessen or increase the weight of the karma. Does that make sense? So for every action, because it will. Something that we think is the right thing to do, but it's wrong. So the result of the karma, what actually happened because of that action, adds weight to what's going on. Make sense? Again, I've got such a little bit of time that I want to go way down this.
Yeah.
Karma is a fascinating subject. It is a very deep subject, and if you go down this path at all, this is the major part of what you will be working with. So we have 4 laws of karma, and then there's 4 or 5 major, what would I call them, Chris, weights? Intention and the result are 2 of them, okay? So let's take killing, okay? If you kill a human versus you kill a mosquito, different weight, okay? So it's that kind of stuff. So that's your intention. I'm trying to do the right thing, but I have the wrong information. One good thing is, would you give everybody, you have an alcoholic, and he has, you know, the DTs, and you give them alcohol to help with something. Well, you're trying to help, but it was obviously the wrong thing to do. So again, this is the whole wisdom. So you've got to have some wisdom to these things too. But if your intention is pure, a lot of parents, their intention is pure, but boy, the results are not so good. So, does that help a little bit? Would that going too far?
I think one thing that might help, I think I've heard it said here that, okay, positive actions cause happiness and negative actions cause suffering. That's a real simple way to look at what's good and what's bad. Does that sound reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was what he was asking for.
Well, it's just what defines positive and what's
right.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the end result, so it's the, you know, you ground your child for doing something wrong. Well, that's, you know, the kids are going to look at it as a negative. You know, you're going to look at it. So there's ramifications to all these things. But your end goal is to keep that child safe for whatever reason. But sometimes you got to do, you know, tougher love type of situation. So the end result is going to have an effect. And giving alcohol to a alcoholic is going to make them very happy for a little bit, isn't it? So what is your definition of the right result? So there's a lot of wisdom that has to go through all of this. Please, go ahead. Wait. We're going to do the mic.
I got to change the battery.
Oh, we've got another one, I think. Yes.
I don't know anything about this, but can you hear me? Does this work?
Yes.
Okay.
Directional mic.
Based on what I heard you say.
Okay.
And his question.
Okay.
It seems to me that if karma is individualized, there's no cosmic scoreboard.
Correct.
Then the subjectivity of the karma really is individualized to that person. So if that person believes that they're doing well by giving an alcoholic alcohol, and they're doing that not because they're thinking down the road this might hurt them, but they're relieving the pain at that moment, hopefully with some consciousness that they're not giving them a pint of alcohol or some detrimental amount of alcohol, they're relieving their pain at that moment. So since karma is individualized, their intent is good. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. They think they're doing well. Their karma then is got one in the non-cosmic scoreboard. That was positive.
That's in theirs, right?
So if
keep going down there, because you also have the negative.
Right.
So keep following.
But I'm not doing a negative. So we're taking this one example, and that's giving the alcoholic alcohol, which could be is a very subjective thing. Anybody can choose their set. You should not do that. You know, you got to suck it up. That's somebody else's subjective idea of how to do that. There's probably science that says don't do that. But it's not for those people to decide. It's the individual whose karma is being affected. What is their intent?
Right. So you have their intent, and again, we're going to be real careful about this.
Then.
Well, it does. So what somebody else doesn't think, what she thinks about it doesn't matter. This is, we're talking about your karma, so
right.
You do it. So her opinion doesn't matter, my opinion doesn't matter, none of that matters. But your intent is part of it. The result of your action, is also going to have karmic good or bad. The result of your action. So your intent is going to do something, okay? There's going to be, and it's not a cosmic scoreboard out there, but you are living with your positive and negative karma, okay? So your intent has karmic repercussions or benefits, okay? But the result of what your action also, this is where some of those levels. So the result of your action also for that action will have karmic
in what time frame?
So that is very dependent on what the action is.
Well, let's talk about the alcohol then.
Okay.
And I know we don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but you give someone alcohol because
right.
they're going through DTs or whatever and you're trying to relieve their pain. You don't want them to die because people can die
right.
in DTs. So you do that. And for 14 years, that helped. Now they die of alcoholism. Did that thing you did 14 years ago, was that a cause or was that a negative effect of what happened to that person 14 years later? Who decides?
Well, it's not a decision. This is that law.
How about
okay.
the karma decide?
So,
how does karma decide? That
well, karma doesn't decide. Just like gravity. Okay, gravity doesn't decide.
Is it positive or negative? It has to go in one column or the other. So somehow it's got to be either positive or negative, right?
Okay, so let me reframe.
I think that's where that suffering or happiness come in.
It is, but it's also okay. So let's take this. I'm trying to think of another analogy. So there's.
Sorry to interrupt. But remember the story that Venerable Bina tells about the guy on the ship? Do you know which one I'm talking about? And the pirate? Okay, I'll just tell it. There's this one enlightened guy, and he's on a ship, and he can, since he's enlightened, he can see everybody's mind and what they're thinking. Let's not worry about that. But that's what you can do when you're enlightened, because you know everything. Well, not. Anyway, so he sees this one guy, that this guy has a thought about killing everybody on the ship. So this enlightened person decides, I'm going to take on the bad karma of killing this guy to prevent him from taking on the bad karma of killing all these people. because if that one guy kills 50 people on the ship, that's really, really bad. But if he can, you know, accept the fact that he's got bad karma by killing this one person, he prevents that one person from getting all that bad karma from killing all the people. So he helps everybody. He helps the person not get the bad karma. He helps all the people because they're not dead. And there is a small negative thing on himself, but he understands how it's all going to work out in the long run. So he does the deed. He kills that guy and prevents all the deaths and the karma, etc. Then over Venus story. Not my
own. And it is, now I know the story. But what I'm going to say, let's take this analogy. You get into a car accident. And they, when you're in a car accident, the law comes in, they take 100% of the fault, right? And then they're going to divvy it up. Well, you were on the road. You didn't have a license, so you're going to get more. You were on the road. You were safe. You were doing everything right, so it's not your fault. But there's still these levels. You were on the road. You were drinking. So much. There's levels of fault there. Does that make sense? Now, don't nod if you really if it doesn't. Okay. So. I'm going to try to think of it.
Karma. With karma,
there's no outside
external thing. It just is. It just happens.
Yeah. So, again, now I'm trying to think. Let's do a karma bucket then. All right. You can be. Okay. So, and again, I wish I had those other notes because here's this karmic result. Okay, so you've done this act. Let's say you've done a potential negative act, giving alcohol to an alcoholic. Would we say that that's a negative act? Okay, but, so you had the right intention, you were trying to because not judging, whatever that is, so there's going to be that much less negative karma that would come with it. Maybe the result this time wasn't as bad. This time the result was not as bad for that gentleman, whoever the alcoholic is. Okay, so the actual result of that action wasn't as bad. So the karmic weight goes down, okay, with those caveats. Okay, I did it for the right reasons. My intention was good. You know, he didn't die. Okay? But now, again, cause. We certainly did nothing potentially to benefit him. Rather than giving him the drink, could we have maybe steered him to a rehab center or something? So because we have these actions, there's always going to be the weight, but it's going to be not as heavy a karmic weight that we're doing. Is that helping? Again, we've got such a short period of time. Yes, sir.
Hi, Drew.
Hi, Drew.
I was just wondering, I'm new here, and I know that when you get into karma, it can get into a lot of finer points that are difficult. But I was just thinking that maybe the most important thing is for me to keep my intentions pure, and if I follow the basic precepts, if I don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't commit sexual misconduct or taking intoxicants, for the most part, my karma is going to be good, right? And I'm going to be okay. And maybe I don't have to worry about that stuff so much.
Right. That's true. That's very true.
I know it's important how all that works, but isn't that like what's most important is what I'm wondering.
Well, it is. But, yeah, it's... I think it's also, so if you can keep your mind there and work on that, then it is. But now what we're trying to break it down. We're just using the analogy of giving an alcoholic alcohol. We can take a completely separate analogy and try to say, that, because again, we're into the negative stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're doing
so
all of the negative stuff.
If I follow those precepts, I could still incur negative karma if I. And
well, if you follow all those precepts,
finer points, this could really.
Let's go there in a minute. Let's finish this because we're going to come up to that. Okay, so let's just go down a different. Your intentions are good. Your intentions are good, but an accident happens, and you.
Still going to have negative karma.
Right. Because your intentions are good. You're not meaning to hurt anybody, but you just, I mean, every time we drive down a road, we're killing insects. Our car is, every single time we do it. This is completely unintentional, but we're doing it. We live in houses that were built because they were insects, you know, were killed because it just because we live in samsara, just because we live in a way and in an environment that this is our karmic world, that unintentionally we're doing it all the time. But our you know, we're trying to be the right people, we're trying to do the right thing. So as much as we can stay there, that's to our benefit. Okay, so again, we're taking just one aspect with one analogy, when I can come up with five more that would still try to explain the point that we're trying to make, that karma has weight. Good karma and bad karma has weight to it, and there's different ways to work with that. If your intention is good, but something bad happens, you know, that's less karmic negative weight. You know, if you're, you know, look at it, there's a lot of people that have bad intentions and good things happen because of them. Well, you know, that's not as karmically beneficial because he was trying to. So a thief breaks into a bank, steals all this money, and as he's going, he gets in a car accident, and all the money flies out. All these people get this money. They're all happy. Well, he didn't mean to, so his intention was bad, but, you know, somebody got some benefit from it. So you can just twist yourself all over with this stuff. All my hope is to just get your foot on the path. Again, Discovering Buddhism has a 6-week course on this. Karma is a huge subject, and it's something that we're always studying. Now, somebody else had another question, or they had their hand up. Yes, sir.
The one thing, if I'm correct, wisdom, which we don't all have, and we all have different levels, makes a big difference whether I know or whether I don't know.
Correct. Very much so. And the wisdom of emptiness is the last class. So we're going to talk about wisdom and what that really means in a Buddhist perspective, because there are levels of wisdom. Somebody that really knows, you can't, that there's an old Buddhist joke that you can't be just smart and you can't be just nice. You have to be both. Because smart people may not have the compassion to help, but compassionate people need to have the wisdom to know what to do. So you have to have wisdom. You have to have both. That's the two wings of the bird of enlightenment, wisdom and compassion, to be able to do the right thing and know when that is. That's actually my main practice. So I'm going to keep going. Karma expands over time. No result without the cause. You will not feel the karmic results, good or bad, of anybody else's actions. You feel yours. I'm not talking about the mundane, somebody punches you, you're going to feel that. I'm talking about the karmic weight. You'll never experience a result without you having created the cause. And karma is not lost. Karma is never lost. Actions always produce a result. Actions always produce a result. And unless your karmic imprints are purified or destroyed. Okay? The four aspects of karma, again, these are not those weights, these aren't the levels. That's again, Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, has lists for lists for lists. So the weight of karma and how it affects you, and the breakdown of that karmic action, they'll do a complete breakdown of each karmic action. And that you'll discover in that Discovering Buddhism class. But these are the four aspects, the ripening result. So what type of rebirth that you have? That's called the ripening result of karma. Possessed result, what type of environment that you're born into? Experiencing the result similar to the cause, you're robbed because you stole something. So a lot of this is just cause and effect, opposites, negative and positive. Creating the results similar to the cause. You steal now because you stole. That's that habit energy. Okay? So these are some of those aspects of karma that you can kind of start to, once you start to work with this and understand it a little bit more, you start to be aware of it. And again, it's being aware of your actions all day, every moment of every day. That's what you're talking about. Okay? So the Buddhist concepts, karma and rebirth, it all kind of flows down to this, the ethical behavior. This is the 10 non-virtuous actions that you were talking about. Body, speech, and mind. We talked about this last time. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. So killing, again, killing a human, killing an insect, killing is killing. But there's different weights. But we do it all the time and we don't think about it. We're not aware of it. Now, it's not to depress us, but it's just to have us aware. Stealing. The Buddhist definition of stealing is taking that which wasn't offered. And again, we can sit here and say, oh, we don't steal. How many times have you ever taken a stamp from work, taken a paper, a notebook, a pen, you know, walking out with the pen from the supermarket? I have a collection, so actually one of, because I do that. I'm terrible. And all of a sudden I'll find all these pens. So how do I do this? You know what? I keep pens in my purse and I will give them. Oh, you don't have a pen? Here, take one of mine, because I certainly probably have taken 10 of yours over the, you know, Harris Teeter. I know I owe them pens. But it's trying to think about it that way. So you go in, you know, my husband likes chocolate and treats, and, you know, there'll be that last Snicker bar in there, and it's like, oh, I'd really like that. But I gave it to him. But if I take it, that's taking that which wasn't offered. It's just an awareness. Again, it's just an awareness. Sexual misconduct, adultery, that type of thing. Rape, anything that would go down that path. Speech, lying, okay? We sometimes, even the white lies that we tell, you know, what is our intent in that? Okay, harsh speech, you know, road rage, anytime you've had that. Harsh speech, hurtful speech, doesn't even have to be swearing. If it hurts somebody, that's harsh speech. Divisive speech, okay, I'm really angry at her, so I'm going to tell you about it so you get mad at her too. Right? Divisive. And it's especially bad if you do that in a spiritual community. So divisive speech can be bad. Gossip. How many of us do that? It's just, that's the nature. You know, oh, did you see what so-and-so did today? Even if you didn't mean it in a negative way, you know, you're still gossiping, and what's the definition of that? You know, there's a negativity that tends to go negative. So it makes you more mindful of your speech and how much we talk during the day that is really not, you know, with a good purpose. The mind, jealousy, covetousness, jealousy. I wish I had that. I wish I did that. Anger is the worst, and we've talked about that. And a lot of us might say that we're not angry people. Impatience is a form of anger. So it's being able to watch your mind. Wrong view, you know, well, I call it willful ignorance, you know, or you sometimes you're doing the best you can, but you know that that's the right way to do it, and you don't. So there's actually several different definitions of that that can go deeper, and I'll let Discovering Buddhism go into that. These all start to kind of pull that into karma and rebirth and what happens. These are the basis of what we're working on. Now, these are the bad parts. Okay, we're going to get to what are the opposites of these, what are the good parts, what are the virtuous actions. So moving on, precious human rebirth, the Buddhist view of death, three scopes, and the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. So again, coming back to the Four Noble Truths, where am I? Okay, time. The truth of suffering, we know that there's suffering in the world, this is the stuff that we were talking about. You know, the three different kinds of suffering. Remember this? Yes, no, maybe? Truth of the cause, why we're suffering. So this is that you have to know you're sick before you're going to do anything about it. The truth of the cause, you go to the doctor and you get the diagnosis. The truth of the cessation, here's the medicine. And the truth of the path, taking the medicine. Otherwise, it's going to sit on that counter and it's not going to do you any good. So the truth of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. We're going to talk about these two today. So precious human rebirth. From a Buddhist perspective, so think about it like this. So we've talked about that stream of consciousness. The fact that we were born human, the fact that not only were we in this room born human, we in this room were born into this Western world where we have been given the freedoms to pursue our studies. Okay, we're not in Nepal where we're suffering from earthquakes and all of these things. We're not in a third world country. We're not in Africa suffering from Ebola. We're born into the United States and we have the freedoms of having really some of the ideal precious human rebirth, right? So that's kind of what they talk about when they talk about the precious human rebirth, because just being born human, we've already got a leg up on the insects, we've already got a leg up on the animals, because they can't practice the Dharma. They can't come to Kadampa Center and learn about Buddhism. They don't have the opportunity. So this is a precious gift that we have. So it's that ideal balance of leisure and suffering, opportunity and motivation. Buddhism describes 18 conditions, again, lists, 18 conditions necessary for a precious human rebirth or the perfect human rebirth. We have the 8 leisures, these freedoms from being born in other realms, freedoms from being born at a time when the Buddha did not appear, in a place where there is no spiritual activity. We've got the 10 endowments, born human, born in a religious country, born with a well-functioning body and mind. We're able to understand the teachings, and we're born at a time when the Buddha has appeared and taught, so in the last 2,500 years. And a perfect human rebirth is considered very rare and very difficult. There's a story, one of the analogies that was given. Okay, so picture the ocean and picture they call it a yoke, I'm going to call it a life preserver, out in the middle of the ocean. And picture a sea turtle out in the middle of the ocean. And the chances of that sea turtle coming up for air and putting his head right in the middle of that life preserver to breathe. So what are the chances of that? Very, very, very impossibly rare, correct? That is the analogy that they give for being born a human. So the preciousness of what we have is incredibly rare. If you think about sentient minds, because Buddhism thinks about all sentient minds, so think about all insects, think about all animals, think about all microbes, okay, because in Tibetan Buddhism, sentient mind is something that can actually take action. Okay? So, if you think about the millions and billions just on this planet, we're not even going to talk about the universe and everything that could bring up. Just on this planet, and then you think, because the first thought is, well, there's lots of humans. Well, we're talking sentient minds. So it kind of brings into that preciousness of human rebirth and how very special that we have it, that we have the ability to study. We have the ability to try to be better people. It's just worthwhile to kind of think about how just taking that as kind of a concept. Does that make sense? A little bit? Yes, sir.
So with that, does that mean that the humans is like the only sentient mind form that can work on its karma?
Well, you're the only one that can actively choose to, aren't you? I don't know any other life form on this planet that can actively have the concept of coming in to work on it. Now, all sentient beings are cause and effect. They're creating more karma with every action, whether you're an ant or a dog or a cat or a bird, insect, whatever. You're always accumulating karma because you're always doing actions, correct? So humans have that special, precious ability to work with your mind and change your mind. So that is that preciousness of human birth. Geshe-la always talks about... So Geshe-la, how many of you have had a chance to see Geshe Gelug Choda, our resident teacher? So he came to the United States about maybe 16 years ago now. Okay, didn't speak English. And he came, and I've actually worked with many of the monks who have come from Sergei Monastery and stuff. And I've also worked actually and had friends that are from different countries, Germany and things like that. And they come over here, and they are in awe. I mean, I picked up two German kids from the airport about 5 years ago. They were going to spend the summer with me. We stopped at the gas station. I sent them in to get a drink, and I had to go track them down because they were wandering the aisles because they just were amazed at how much we had. I spent 2 weeks up at a retreat working with some other Buddhist monks from Kopan Monastery, and honestly, we probably spent 20 minutes in the bread aisle because they couldn't believe all the different brands of bread, and then another 10 minutes in the toothpaste because they couldn't understand why we had so many. I mean, they were asking me serious questions about all of these products that we had. It was hilarious, but it makes you understand. Geshe-la says that for Americans, that we must have been so incredibly generous in our previous lives. We must have been so incredibly wonderful to be born in such a place that many of the Tibetans or people that come over just think that this is the Pure Land. This is like heaven to them. They can't believe the things that we have. They can't believe the fresh air and the clean water that we have that we take for granted. To them, think about it. Think about taking somebody from one of these third world countries and taking them home. What an amazing thing that they would feel. So start to think about that. I love when Geshe-la, he just talked about it just last Sunday or the Sunday before, that we all must have been so generous in our previous lives to be living this life that we have today. And I think so many times we don't tend to think about it like that. So that's an awareness that I love. So that's that preciousness of human life, and especially that we have been given. We have the time to be here and doing this. There's a lot of people in a lot of different countries that don't have the time to pursue studies like this. So we're very, very fortunate. So now let's talk about the Buddhist view of death. So this, I'm going to wing through this stuff. Okay, so the Buddhist view of death is actually so much different than Americans, okay? So my first question is, how many of you have seen a dead body? Okay, that's actually more than normal. That's actually more than normal. Here in the West, we fight everything about death. We don't talk about it. We don't show it. We don't have our children involved in it. We even fight the look of it. I mean, it's a how many billions of dollar industry to have the facelifts and the hair coloring and all the things that we do to avoid it. We don't have it in our everyday conversation at all in the West. Would you agree with that? Okay, we try to shelter our children from it. We shelter our families from it. And a lot of people just haven't experienced it. You guys, this is a huge class for that. I'm actually quite surprised. The Buddhist view of death is that since we are working with our mind stream, since we believe in rebirth, since we believe that our mind stream will go on, that we are kind of the carriers of our mind and we have the ability to do that, we work towards setting up that next life. So we look at death in a different way. In fact, there's actually death meditations that we actually, the Dalai Lama does a death meditation practice, I've heard, 6 times a day. Because we believe that we have the ability to work with our mind so that when that time comes, because it's going to, there isn't a single person in this room that isn't going to die. But many people are afraid of it. We believe that it's possible to work with your mind so that you can not only not be afraid of it, that when the process starts, that you have the ability to go through the process, and there's actually a point in time during that death process where you can affect your rebirth. Now, that is those are great masters that are able to do that. Okay? But that is the concept that we have. Now, we do know that most of the time fear is because of the unknown. Would you agree to that statement? Most of the time you're afraid of something because you don't understand it and you don't know about it. So the death meditation actually walks you through that process. I do it. I've done it. But I've also had two near-death experiences. So I've felt it. And I think I'm very fortunate because of that. Because I've experienced it a little bit, I'm not as afraid of it, and I've actually worked with it. But to actually have that control so that you have that potential ability to affect your next rebirth, that's really what we try to strive for. Make sense? Questions? How many of you think that's totally wacky weird? That's okay. That's okay. That's the point. It's just being honest, because you're going to find that there are a lot of concepts that you either might not understand or might not agree with. You know, I always challenge people to sit. The Buddha has a statement where he says, don't just believe something because we say it. Don't just believe something because he said it. Take that teaching, take that piece or that concept and look at it. So when they define gold, when they assay gold, okay, they do all of these tests on that gold to find the purity of the gold, right? He says to look at his teaching, to look at his concepts, just like you're trying to figure out how pure that gold is. Okay, just because he's saying it, you can reject it if you find it's not true for you. Okay? You are supposed to question all of this. This is about your mind, and we're just offering these concepts, and check it out. There is a difference between blind faith, okay? The Buddha does not ask you to have any blind faith in anything. It is not. You can have what we call experiential faith. I have done this myself. Geshe-la's teachings work for me. I understand them. So you know what, if he says something that I don't quite understand, I'm going to give it a try because I have faith in his teachings because I have a history of it. I'm not going to believe it just because he says it. Okay? I have faith because he's practiced and he's done these things and I've tried some of the stuff that he's taught me that's worked for me. So you know what, I'm going to give it a try. I have faith enough to give it a try. But blind faith is not, there. That isn't even a concept in Buddhism. Check it out. If you don't agree with it, if you don't believe it, then move on. It's like going into a supermarket. Here's all these practices, and it's up to you to figure out, and we'll lay things out, and then you see if it works for you, then great. But we do ask that you give it a real try. Really sit down and think about it. And if it doesn't work, then let it go. I have this kind of mental bookshelf, and there'll be concepts that I don't know, don't quite get it, so I'll stick it up on the bookshelf. And I swear, most of the things have come off of that bookshelf. It's like all of a sudden I'll be in a teaching with somebody and it's like, oh, that's what that means. But then other things have gone back up on the bookshelf because, you know, it's just, I don't quite get it yet. So check it out. There's not a thing that anybody is going to tell you that you have to believe because we say so. All right. So Buddhist view of death. Here's your homework. Here's your homework. Don't you think that you would act differently if you thought you were going to die tomorrow? If you thought, tomorrow at 6 o'clock, I'm going to die, wouldn't you go through your day a little bit differently? Wouldn't you maybe look at things a little bit differently? Now, we still have to pay our bills. We still have to live in this world. So it's not like, you know, you always hear those stories about people being given a cancer diagnosis and they go out and they run up all their bills and they have all of this fun and they do all of these things and then they find out that, you know, for whatever reason it wasn't, so they're going to live and now I have to deal. I'm not saying that. So you still have to deal with things. But if you knew, if you lived your life like you were going to die, which is what we are, would you live it slightly differently? Would you think about it differently? So the homework is, tomorrow morning, as soon as you wake up and as soon as you can remember, as soon as you think of this, I want you to think, I'm going to die at 6 p.m. today. I promise you won't. This is just a practice. Okay? But I want you to think, and I want you to, it's just like the red light thing. You know, you're going to laugh at me, but Sandy said, oh yeah, I got to do this. You may be on your third cup of coffee when it comes to you, whatever. As soon as you can, I want you to think, I'm going to die at 6 p.m. tonight. And I want you to be aware of your day. Would you still have to go to work, okay? I'm not saying take the day off and go to the beach. You get through your life, okay? But if you were going to die, would you maybe treat people a little differently? Would you possibly be a little nicer? Would you possibly, whether you believe in God or Jesus or Buddha or whatever it is that you believe in, would you act a little bit differently if you thought you were going to die? And just see how your day would unfold. Would that sunshine look a little brighter? Would that grass look a little greener? Would those flowers smell a little bit better? Would you take a little bit more time during the day to notice them? So it's just a practice. It's just an awareness. So think about it. And then when 6 p.m. comes, you can rejoice that you didn't and think, I have another opportunity. I have another opportunity to be a kinder, better person because I didn't die today. So maybe I can do a little bit more with my life. Maybe I can do a little bit more to be a better person and to help somebody else out. It's just a practice. Okay. So the three scopes, an understanding of karma, rebirth, and the value of our life leads us, you know, usually to a spiritual path. You guys are all here out of curiosity of a spiritual path. Okay? A little bit curiosity, a little bit trying to find it. For whatever reason, we're here for some of that. All right? And that's part of what we hope is at least inspiring us to live a little bit more of a purposeful life and not waste this time that we have, this precious human life. So in Tibetan Buddhism, that leads us to what's called the Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment. And you're going to hear that book a lot. You're going to hear that study a lot, the Lam Rim. It is, I call it, the original Buddhism for dummies. All right? It is not the gradual path. It does not mean you start here and if you do these steps. It means the graduated path because it's a practice. You're going to go up, you're going to go down, you're going to go back, you're going to go up, you're going to get things, you're going to get this 10 list, this 5 list. But it offers different scopes and different instructions for levels of practice. The lower scope is focused on the goal of a fortunate rebirth. And for many of us, that's a big goal because, that, you know, I'm thinking I might not hit enlightenment this life, but I'd sure like to try next life. So I have aspirational wishes of meeting the Dharma sooner, getting things sooner. So I really, really, really want to do all the things I can do to come back with the precious human life so I can study more. Then you have the middle scope focused on the goal of liberation from suffering and freedom from cyclic existence. So that's really more about nirvana, reaching that nirvana, okay? Trying to control my mind enough that I can cleanse it a little bit, get rid of some of the negative, focus on the positive. Greater scope focused on full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So, greater, middle, lesser. You can take teachings in all of them at the same time. It isn't like you have to do this and then this and then this. It is all mixed up, but it's a way to break it out so you can understand it a little bit easier. Okay? The greater scope, you can't, it's just like being a swimmer, you can't save somebody else until you know how to swim. Right? So don't, you have to kind of learn all of them at the same time, but they break it out so that it's a little bit easier to understand. And then the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And Okay, I'm going to give you guys the choice because we're running out of time. Renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. We have 15 minutes left in this class, and we have an hour and a half in the next class, and that's it. Then we're done. There are other classes you can take that will dive into a lot of this in more detail. So we can cover renunciation, bodhicitta, and keep working on those two things right now till the end of the class. Or we can save and try to hit renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom of emptiness at the last class and do that analytical meditation. So either one is fine with me. So I'm going to raise a voice, keep talking, and go over renunciation and bodhicitta, or try an analytical meditation. Okay. Analytical meditation. I'm glad you chose this because this is one of my favorite meditations. Okay. So, and then I'll fly like the devil trying to get through everything next class. Okay, so, again, two types of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. Concentration meditation is just like going to the gym with your mind. You have to learn how to concentrate before you can actually work with your mind. Well, now that we have this and we know about concentration meditation, so what do we do with that? Analytical meditation is we're going to actually choose a subject and we're going to work on it. We're going to choose a subject and we're going to work with our minds. And I'm going to give you one called equanimity. So we're kind of jumping into it a little bit because normally I've explained what equanimity is. So I'm going to give you a bit of an let's go there just so you can understand it a little bit. Yep. Yeah, I'm skipping. I'm skipping way ahead. Yeah, so we got to go through all this stuff tomorrow or next week. Okay, equanimity. Equanimity is the absence, I'm going to give you the actual definition, the absence of the usual discrimination of sentient beings into deriving that realization that we're not going to put these sentient beings in a box. Friend, enemy, because we do that. Driving from the realization that all beings are equal in wanting happiness and the freedom from suffering. Everything. Would you agree to that? Even a mouse. They're going to run away from pain. They just want to be happy. What does happiness mean to a mouse? Food, comfort, water. They just want to be happy, right? We can agree with that. Everybody in this room just wants to be happy. Would we all agree with that? Nobody in this room wants to suffer. Would we all agree with that? So if we can actually do what's called equanimity and try to level that playing field so that we understand that everybody has the same wants and needs. Everybody, every sentient mind just wants to be happy and free from suffering. Everyone, every being. So we're going to do a meditation called equanimity. Now I'm going to take it even further on this explanation. Because again, I try to apply these things in my everyday life. So we think of people as friend, loved one, neutral. There's that lady at the post office or the guy, you know, delivering at the FedEx or the Harris Teeter beggar, people we don't really know. So they're neutral. We have enemies, people we don't like. Hate is a strong word. I don't usually use that word. People I don't like as much. Okay, we have those people. So I'm going to give you a specific example because I've been studying this for a while, and I still work with that. So in my business world, I actually had a vendor that I was having problems with. I did not like working with this vendor, and every time I had to call him, I could feel it. I could feel that stress coming up, and I could feel the problems, and it's like, you know what? But I was forced to use him. Okay, my client, this was their vendor, had to do it. So I was getting upset all the time, and I would see that caller ID, and I would go, ah. Okay, just like the red light, ah, there it is. So actually one time I sat down, and I used this specific meditation, this equanimity meditation, and I used this on that vendor. And when I called, so I did this before I had to call him because I thought, I got to get a hold of my negative mind. And when I called him, my voice was different. My attitude was different. And I had a phenomenal phone call. And because I was different, I can't change him. Because my voice was different, obviously it changed the subject. Obviously he felt a little bit differently. That conversation went very well. And it opened up. And now, guess what? He's fine. And we get along. All from, specifically for me, this meditation. So I'm going to work with you on this. Let's give it a shot. This is called Equanimity Meditation. It is in several books in different formats, but this is what this is. So we're actually going to work on this. And you're going to need to do this a couple times. We'll do this time, and then we'll do it at the beginning of the next class to give you a little bit more time to work with it. Because as I read this, you're going to come up with thoughts and ideas in your head, and this is the first time through. So it's going to be a little hard, but you can think about it, and we'll do it again at the next time, okay? All right. Focus your attention on your breath and use one of the various breathing meditations. So get in your position. Sit comfortably. And just breathe for a minute. And settle your mind. So do the breathing. Do one of the breathing exercises that we've done for a few minutes. We're going to set a motivation. We're going to generate the strong intention to do this meditation in order to overcome self-centered bias and judgments and to develop the mind of perfect equanimity and balance toward others. So again, just get into that position, calming your mind and preparing it for the meditation. Imagine in the space in front of you three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent toward. So think of those three people and keep them in your mind throughout this meditation. First, focus on your friend or your loved one. And allow your feelings for that person to arise strongly. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely and truly a friend. A person who's good to you, fulfills your needs and wishes. And feel how you really want this person to be happy and identify yourself with those good feelings. Now shift your attention to your enemy, this person that you dislike, who's not kind to you, who doesn't satisfy your needs, who maybe annoys you or makes you angry, hurts you, hurts your feelings. Regard this person carefully and look at the feelings that you have about this person. Now shift your attention to this so-called stranger, the person that you barely know, but whom you neither like or dislike. You don't know them well enough. And look carefully at that person and note maybe the feelings of indifference. Now consider and recognize that the nature of your relationships with each of these three people and the labels that you have put on each of them are based solely on what they do or don't do for you at this point in time. Think of people who have been your friend and then became your enemy. And maybe vice versa, strangers who became friends when you got to know them, or maybe enemies, maybe they did something to hurt you so you don't like them. So think about the fact that these labels are temporary and can be impermanent. It's just what the situation is at this current time. Now move your attention back to your friend and imagine a situation that would cause the friendship to end. Imagine that your friend turns against you and experiences the resentment and anger and hurt that you would feel in such a situation. Do you still feel warm and friendly toward that person? Do you still wish him or her well and want that person to be happy? Where is your friend now? Now remember that this person was not your friend before you were even acquainted. And recognize how easily this person could cease to be your friend now, just as you've just imagined. So think to yourself that there's no true sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only that friend at this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now move your attention to the present enemy. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together and become close, a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look at that person and your feelings toward them very carefully. Are your feelings softening at all, becoming warmer? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemies. This has happened before and it will again. Why do we hold so strongly to the concept that this person is definitely enemy? Now move your attention to the stranger. And imagine how one act of kindness or one act of anger from this person could immediately turn him or her into a friend or an enemy. There is no inherent, definite stranger there. There is no sound reason for the feelings of indifference that we hold on to. Remember that your present friend and your present enemy were both strangers to you beforehand. And this enemy could become a friend or an enemy now. Maintain your awareness of these three people in front of you. Think about the fragile impermanence of these relationships. And it's only your misconceived belief in the concreteness of these labels, a friend, enemy, and stranger, that holds your mind back from the possibility of change and fluidity. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness just as much as you do. These three people, that's what they want too. In this respect, we're all equal. Everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their mind to the fullest extent and to achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The differences that we see in people are superficial, based only on our mistaken and narrowly self-centered views. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. Now, none of this means that we should not discriminate at all. On a practical level, our ability to distinguish between actions and individuals is very necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not in any way contradictory to the meditation. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, for their well-being, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that the labels that we put on others are often arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable. Finally, just stop and think about those three people and all they want is to be happy and free from suffering, every single one of them, as well as yourself. Dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Now, that was a very quick run-through of equanimity. And we'll talk about it more in the next class, but if you can visualize that and start taking that feeling that you have for that friend, that feeling that you have for that loved one, and sharing that, because love is not finite. And understanding that that person over here that you don't like or that's bothered you or hurt you is just trying to be happy too. It does not mean that if somebody's hurting you physically, emotionally, that you don't step away. Okay, we're going to get into some of that too. Okay, so, but if they're just, if it's a work thing, if it's a family thing that you can deal with, you know, they're just trying to be happy. We don't know where they're at. We don't know their stories. And all they're looking for is to be happy too. So it's an interesting practice. See, we've done it with people, and it's interesting to take it further. So we'll talk about this more next time. We'll go through all of the other things next time. Next time is our last class. So we're going to go through emptiness. We'll get through the last of the Four Noble Truths, Renunciation, Bodhicitta, and the Wisdom of Emptiness. So that's going to be big concepts. And again, we're not going to completely understand them, but at least I can give you the Buddhist explanation of it, because there's a lot of misconceptions about especially renunciation and emptiness, a lot of misconceptions. So hopefully we'll get to at least started on that Buddhist definition of those. Thank you so much for coming. If you're receiving any benefit out of this class, all of us here are volunteers. We have a few very, very shallowly paid staff here, but it costs money to, I love those trains. That's the practice. To pay the mortgage and keep the lights and the air conditioning on. So if you're so moved, generosity is one of the six perfections. We'll talk about that later. But thanks all for coming. You guys have put in, this is the eighth, it's been 6 hours. You guys have put in 6 hours with me, and I really appreciate your patience with me. Okay, what's happening tomorrow morning? You're going to die. What's happening at 6? Rejoice that you didn't die. So, yeah, so just try that. Just keep it in your mind, okay? And see if you don't act a little bit differently. You still have to go to work. You still, you know, just think about it. Thank you.